Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Tess Barry. Tess Barry has an MA in English from the University of Pittsburgh and is currently completing her MFA in poetry at Carlo University. She was a finalist for North American Review's 2012 James Hurst Poetry Prize and will be published in North American Review's Spring 2013 edition. Her work has appeared most recently in the Carlo Journal and Carlo University Press's anthology, Voices from the Attic, Volume 18. Her manuscript is entitled Spring Barrel. Hi, Tess. How are you?
I'm well. How are you? Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming. And I wanted to say big congratulations for the North American Review finalist James Hurst Poetry Prize.
It's been very exciting. I'm looking forward to being published in the magazine.
Yeah, it's such a great thing. So really, really exciting. Okay, so why don't you just start with some poems from your manuscript?
Okay, I'm going to begin today with I've read a lot of poems about my childhood. I grew up in Western Pennsylvania, and I'll begin with a poem that was inspired by the poet Ruth Stone, who also kind of, you know, writes a lot about her background, and she's a poet I identify with. Raspberries. I started out in Western Pennsylvania hills with wild raspberry and blackberry bushes and my mother's apple field. Bread and ripe fruit and fresh milk. My mother cleaned the carpet right off the floor. My father was a Troy Hill boy who played piano and smoked Pall Malls and drank whiskey. He won my mother in a dance contest. Who wouldn't want to learn to jitterbug for a prize like her? They took a train to Cape Cod for a honeymoon and bought hats for their mothers. They sailed all the way from the Cape to 10 children. My whole life has been ripe with wild fruit. All the men I've loved had left feet. I was innocent until I got myself a good pair of rain boots. There is no point in wondering what I'll come to. With my first words, I wrote my own path straight to New York. All night accents, brick stoops. I left there like a mad dog running free, like our Dusty who got himself killed down the street, chasing the neighborhood boys. He ran smack into a fender. We buried him up in the woods after a proper funeral. No amount of experience can shake the ripeness out of me, or my mother, or my father, who didn't just win a bride with his right feet and big shoes. He won a green thumb. This next poem is, we had a tragedy in my family last summer, an unexpected death of a nephew. And this is a poem that was inspired by Pablo Picasso's Blue Period. The paintings that he painted in blue. For some reason, when I'm feeling low, these are paintings I return to and think about. And I was thinking about him and looking at some of his paintings, and I wrote this poem. On finding my bearings in Picasso's Blue Period. When I am sad, I return to your Blue Period and rest there. I read and walk on blue sand, swim in melancholy, drown my longings in brushwork and white caps. Press myself between your poor people on the seashore. I turn to your mother first, her arms crossed and head down, wrapped in the cape of herself, unified in blue monochrome. I give her some bread, which she takes, never looking into my eyes. She doesn't acknowledge me, doesn't even acknowledge your abrupt and smooth sea. I turn to your father, hold his elbows, offer him shelter. Back to the shore, he faces her, faces emptiness, faces me too, but our eyes never meet. Their young son faces them both, a force and a presence. One hand rests on his father's dark thigh, another floats free, grasps my offering. Arm in arm, we turn toward your blued sea. find our bearings in the thick, even strokes, in your constancy. This next poem is a poem about a character from my childhood. We had a day laborer in the neighborhood who worked for a man who owned a lot of property near the home where I grew up, and his name was Beansy. And he figured very prominently in my childhood because he was always outside, and as children, we were always interacting with him. Spring Barrel. Beansy walked with both arms swung forward, carrying some imaginary weight. Hands wide open low, was gangly, seemed always to be tipping over. His dirty overalls held up by suspenders, but loose like they might fall off. He was slow-witted, Dad said, not right in his mind. Mom said he was harmless. His strangely tiny head held two eyes out of focus, so when he looked at you, he was looking off in two different directions. Beansy talked funny, slurred thickly like his tongue was swollen, spit tobacco juice, sometimes smelled like whiskey, farmed Clarence's field next door, gathered spring water in a barrel, made rain there too, my brother swore, when I asked him what a spring barrel was for. Beansy dug ditches, hoed, planted corn, snap peas, staked tomato vines and grapes for wine, sung to himself in curse words. Working in a ditch, you son of a gun, you'll never get rich working in a ditch. Laid a manure chute from the unpaved road above. When he was not looking, we rode it like a rocket, sliding on our backs through its grimy silver cone to the open till of earth below. Beansy took a shine to my elder sister Mary, a tomboy but getting tall and pretty. One Sunday, he appeared with a brand new bicycle for Mary's 13th birthday. Dad was angry, said absolutely not. Then later, we don't need his charity. Made Beansy take that bicycle away. Mom said she's a kind girl. It's because she's been kind to him. We were told stay away from Beansy, but went on waving, talking, sliding through that chute when he wasn't looking. He went on digging, cursing, singing, his two crazy eyes rolling, arms lolling forward, tipping over like a scarecrow making rain in a spring barrel. This next poem is a poem that was inspired by the poet Les Murray, an Australian poet that I've been reading over the last couple of years and really come to love. And when I wrote it, I was thinking about specifically his poem Migratory, but also about the seasons changing and how wonderful it is to see the cycle of life yearly and to live in a place where the seasons change. Deciduous. I am the seed that roots and spreads. I am the underbough unbearing. I am the meristem, the forest in refuge, the division in moss and the division in fern. I am the absence of sound in deep rise, in snow-buried mound, in matter-of-fact serration. The feeling of stillness that widens and widens, then rustles and spills from forked tongue to tadpole-spitting stream. I am boundlessness of now, when it is good to bear nothing but the weight of its great vastness. While winters pass from absence to deafening gathering to absence again, many rebirths and sprawling coverings, till the falling ahead becomes the falling behind, and half the short seasons of the day are sameness. Widening pools cast my perpetual echo. I am bark of skin dividing out. I am winged vertebrae weaving. I am cambium, the forest in refuge, the division in fern, the place of meristem division.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Tess Barry, reading from her manuscript entitled Spring Barrel. Tess, I wanted to talk to you about a lot of things, but there's so much there. I mean, those poems have such a strong voice and offer so much to talk about. But one thing I'm really struck by is the visceral detail in your work. It just seems like regardless of what you're talking about in your poems, there's this depth and this sort of, relationship with the earth or the body that's happening in your poems. I don't know if that rings true for you, but, when you're talking about bearings and background and, just that title poem, Spring Barrel, just drives us right into, to me, a relationship between people and nature. So I don't know if you could grab on to anything there.
Yeah, I think that poem in particular, for me, is very representative of this kind of childhood experience that I think is constantly being repeated in the poetry that I write. I grew up in a big family of 10 children, in a very working class family, and was fortunate to have a mother who encouraged us and spent a lot of time outside with us. So we were always walking and playing outside, and she sort of revered nature. She loved to garden, and I think those kinds of that kind of encouragement from her made the natural world very important to me. And so I'm always trying to situate myself, my physical self, in the natural world and sort of identifying with anything that recalls those particular themes.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. But that idea of situating oneself seems to be really important in your poems. When you talked about your poem on finding my bearings in Picasso's Blue Period, I wanted to ask you if you often use art. I mean, you talked about using art with grief, but if you often use art in your writing, if you write in relation to art or use art as a way to get into a meditative state to write.
I think I do. I certainly, there's certain art, pieces of art, sculpture, paintings that I return to and find inspiration and comfort in. And I think specifically works of literature, poets, and, I'm a big reader and I love to read fiction and nonfiction and poets of all kinds. So I'm always reading, and a lot of times, reading a book of poetry, reading a poem, or seeing some work of art will inspire me, and that will bring a poem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I was talking mostly about visual art, since you were, sort of referring in that poem to Picasso's Blue Period. But I know you're a lover of visual art. But so it sounds like that's not so much maybe how your writing process works, through visual art.
No, I don't know that if it does, it's definitely on an unconscious level. I mean, I do love art, and I love to be surrounded by it. I'm always buying this or that to have in my home, and I think that probably has a kind of a subconscious effect on me. Yeah. But as far as art that influences me or that inspires me in terms of writing, I think nothing inspires me more than the written word.
Right.
And any kind of literature, any kind of poetry or other forms of literature, I continue to find. And I return to a lot of poets that I've loved and find inspiration in them, find means of getting my own poems going.
Okay. Can you read some more?
Sure. This next poem is a poem that was written in the wake of a experience of déjà vu, and I'm not sure how many people have had that experience. I've had it several times in my life, and it's a sort of uncanny, uneasy experience. And I had it on a trip to Old San Juan many years ago, and wrote this poem about that. Between water and the sun's bright glare, Fort San Felipe del Moro rose up from a bluff high above the Atlantic. As we drove along the sea, I saw giant sails blow in and out, and said to my then fiancé, "I remember seeing this before as we drove in from the airport, but we hadn't come that way. And when we parked, I said the ships in the bay looked ancient, as though they'd been rigged for some historic celebration." He looked at me like I was crazy, said he couldn't see any ships, and the closer we got to the bluff, the more frightened I became. As we mounted the steps to the fort, I looked up again and saw a woman who looked like me, only she was wearing a long white dress and looking out towards the sea, seeing the sails I saw. Her hand bent over her eyes to shade them because the sun was high, making it impossible to see anything clearly. I saw her there and turned, ran down the hill and back to the car. I left him with a woman in a white dress, turned towards the sea, who looked just like me. When I reached the car, I turned to see thousands of ships in San Juan Bay and that woman still standing there, her dress billowing in and out, scanning the horizon almost frantically. She was searching for a lover, a husband, caught somewhere between water and the sun's bright glare. This next poem I'm going to read is a poem I wrote for the Nobel laureate Seamus Heaney. Over the last couple of years, I've read a lot of his work, both his prose and poetry, and he's been a very important poet for me as a writer. He's been very inspiring, and this poem draws extensively from his poetry, his collected prose, and a number of other places, including his Nobel laureate speech, and some interviews he's given to American publications. Love Song to Seamus Heaney in 5 parts. You are surface water rippling towards thirst, a space station of weighted bogland. You are knifed air framing a votive panel to Orpheus. Love and trust indigenous. Amphilos, slanted truth teller of Moss Bon, Belfast, Dublin. You are the Tallinn man, a funeral pyre of Danes, James Joyce falling from a green hooded spigot, coal grounds soaked in held breath. You are the giver who remembered to lick the rim, the enjoyment of all Pat McGookins. You are revelation in an earthworm's tube, the bucketed pour of catharsis. Seamus Heaney, he spat from the well ran dry, so he spat from the sky was too wide, so he spat from the ground. Alms to your soul, Seamus Heaney, for spitting so low. I want to crawl into your lap and fall asleep against your jaunty chin, to peel potatoes for you while you sing. I want to touch your facial planes, drink from each brailed stream, ruffle your white hair and kiss your eyelids. Hear your Orphic breath draw itself out in speech. Bow before your calloused pith. Eldest child of 9, a song of 9s for you from 9th of 10. 9 pleasant splashes to bring us to our senses. 9 14-carat nibs, 9 pinpricks on the mite box card, 9 rain sticks upended, 9 swans at evening over Loch Enubar, 9 ladies frilled and tartaned, 9 hills of Anahorish, 9 windy boar trees, 9 breaths pluming 9 just men for Diogenes. Braced waybridge bent low by wind and wood note. Are you not Dante? Grit and root of bough that bears true fruit, rough sews the woodwind's coat. Stone-celled metaphor, simile of plow. O long-tailed consonant, corn-craking vow. Dinna deny me, Seamus, dinna now. This next poem is another poem from my mother. I've written a lot of poems for my mother. I don't think I'm reading a lot of them, but I have written a number of poems for her. And this is a poem that uses the poetic form, the pantoum. It uses repetition. My mother was born with a birth defect, which she later learned in life was in fact spina bifida occulta. And this poem takes that as its subject. For my mother, in the winter of 1931, my mother was nearly aborted. The details are sketchy. Already mother to eight of her own when she learned. Born with a tiny hole at the base of her spine, never mentioned at home. The details are sketchy. Applying to the Air Force at 18, she was examined and informed. Born with a tiny hole at the base of her spine, never mentioned before. Diagnosis, spina bifida occulta, which sounds like a spell but isn't. Applying to the Air Force at 18, she was examined and informed. Nearing 40, her mother wrote to say she'd almost been aborted. Diagnosis, spina bifida occulta, which sounds like a spell but isn't. Her mother'd had a change of heart during her ridding, ran off before he finished. Nearing 40, her mother wrote to say she'd almost been aborted. Grandmother took the blame for her belly button spine and never mentioned it again. She'd had a change of heart during the ridding. Ran off before he finished. First of seven born to Rose and Harold, my mother a mother to 10 of her own. Grandmother took the blame for her belly button spine and never mentioned it again. The details are sketchy. First of seven born to Rose and Harold, my mother a mother to 10 of her own. In the winter of 1931, nearly aborted.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Tess Barry, reading from her manuscript entitled Spring Barrel. Tess, I wanted to talk for a minute about the sound in your poems, which I think is great.
Thank you.
And how it seems to me to support the this sensuality in your work. And also, I'm still thinking about how form and sound situate the self in your poems. But I want to ask you about your writing when you're writing a poem. If you are ever initially driven by sound to write, or if you're driven by sound in revision sometimes. I mean, I know you just read a pantoum, but I also know that you have sonnets that you've altered, so they're not sonnets and they're become half sonnets. So can you talk about those choices of working with sound?
I think for me, one of the reasons I love Seamus Heaney is because his work is all about sound. And I think that reading his work really made, as a poet, made me think more about sound. But I still feel like when I'm actually writing a poem, it's not necessarily a conscious thing. And definitely going back in revision, you know, it comes into play more, but there's something about hearing poetry read, in the sounds of words. It's you know, it's an amazing thing, what sound can do in terms of effect. And I don't know that I'm always aware of that, but I am when I'm hearing somebody else read. So I'm trying to be more aware of it as I write, and you know, some of it is unconscious, and I've experimented with forms. You know, I think sometimes sound can also be too deliberate or too studied. So I do worry about that if I'm writing in a form, but I love it, and I'm trying to experiment more with it. I mean, there's something very kind of concrete about sound, you know, that's nice. It has a grounding effect for me.
That's interesting. Yeah, and repetition of sound. I also wanted to ask you if you feel yourself in conversation with these writers in your poems, like you've mentioned Ruth Stone, Les Murray, Seamus Heaney, Do you imagine your poems as in conversation with them, or do you imagine yourself in conversation in your head with them, and then the poems come out? Or
yeah, I think no, I think the first the idea that you're in conversation with anything that's influencing you, you know. So writing a poem about Pablo Picasso's painting, there is a sense of being in conversation with him. And when I wrote that poem, you know, I returned to a painting, The Poor People at the Seashore, and it had such an effect on me. I felt almost as though I were writing the poem for him. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, the most powerful art is art that does that to us, that brings us intimately engaged with the artist who's created it, whether it's a work of fiction or poetry or a painting or a sculpture.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. I mean, I get that feeling when listening to your poems that there's a number of people here, you know, in the poem.
A lot of ghosts.
Ghosts.
Yeah, and living, and a lot of people I don't know. Yeah. I'm just engaging with.
Yeah, different levels. I mean, which is great. I mean, the one poem you were talking about, ghosts, but feelings of having been up in a place before. So it seems, and you've said subconscious a number of times, so it seems like there's a lot of people here in a good way. We have time for more.
Okay, I'm going to, the next poem I'm going to read is a poem I wrote this summer. I was out for a jog in my Pittsburgh neighborhood, and it was a hot summer day, and I was feeling overwhelmed with the heat and kind of longing for the endless days of childhood summers, and got home and wrote this poem. Emptied of all but wildness. Running past an urban field, emptied of all but wildness. I see a scattered patch of bricks, sprawling weeds grown brown and tall, and in among them glimpse some purpled heads of summer clover. They bend and blow toward me. A single Queen Anne's lace rises, plain and white, its tiny clusters pleading until I stop to peer and pluck them free. Pausing there, I breathe again the woven afternoons of August, my fingers threading stalks of daisies, plaiting latticed faces to fit damp heads. All summer long, we crowned our days in petaled greens and whites and yellows, to drift resplendent in those common wilted hours, to lap at sweetness among hidden bees, knee-deep in clovered meadows, emptied of all but wildness.
It's the poetry of Tess Berry. Thank you so much for being here. That was great.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's a thrill to be here.
You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in Saturday mornings at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 FM.